Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our increasingly infrequent Thursday streams.
Hello.
Hello. We're sorry it's been so long, guys. We're sorry it's been such a while, but quite honestly, the political environment is so loud and at such fever pitch that there's not a lot we can talk about that won't be completely drowned out. We tend to go for a lot more evergreen topics, or we do our annoying thing of existing in the political future. And yes, we've not working. No, it does seem to be, we do seem to be live. Yes, we are definitely live, guys. Don't you worry.
We 100% are not like a recording or anything like
that. No. We are not an AI.
I can't remember before or not if I have done this bit, but of course we are streaming live from the Tora Bora PS3 supercomputer.
Yes, we are. That we are streaming live from the Tora Bora supercomputer. This is why also we tell people to refresh.
Yeah.
If you've ever had trouble getting a live stream live on YouTube, it's probably because you haven't refreshed the page.
Yes, and for those that are wondering, I'm not even going to mention the weather, because we all know.
Yeah, we all know. It's shocking. We have not had a summer. The weather has been terrible. We've not had a summer as yet at all.
I must say, it is with great sadness, actually, that I have come to a major revelation.
Yes.
Worry not, my love for the nation of Israel will never fade, if not that. But it's almost as important to me. That I think I might vote.
Oh, no.
If someone comes out and says, I will make the sun come back out, I might have to vote.
Okay, so that's our platform. We will return the sun to you.
Bring back
the
sun!
We will destroy the clouds!
Yes.
That's a good segue to talk about the fact that we are still monetized somehow. The best way to donate to us is via the Ko-fi, because it doesn't pay the Google tax, but we just got £20 there from Ethan. Thank you, Ethan. He says, Henlo.
These are some expensive Hemloads.
Oh, thank you, Lamented Guide, for the $20. Henlo, friends, we'll give you another Henlo. But, yes, but we're not really going to vote, guys. We're more joking about
I'm deeply serious. I will vote for whoever can promise me to bring the sun back.
You can't vote. You're not on your Toro register properly, which is...
I've seen what happens around these parts. I just need to find a nice Asian man outside of the polling booth sitting in there, and an old Volkswagen Sharan with a 3-foot-tall stack of polling cards. Oh, yes, of course. My name's Mohammed, too.
We did actually see somebody of an Asian persuasion coming out of a fancy vehicle with a lot of polling cards once. But we mostly just laughed, because that's mostly what we expect. But anyway, today we are going to talk about, I suppose, what will be an easily misconstrued topic. This is a bit of an intelligence test.
Oh, no, I hope it is misconstrued. Peter Hitchens, if you're out there watching us, hello.
Hello.
We love Starmer. And as I reply to one of A's tweets, I see him mincing about in the chat there, something to the effect of, I want such a large Starmer majority that I want him to start wearing capes.
Winston Churchill, lad.
Yeah. And fundamentally, we are going to have to discuss the fact that he is going to be the man that keeps the trains on time.
He is going to actually be the man who makes the trains run on time, yes. I'm sorry to say it, but we are not talking about the election, really. We're actually talking about how British politics will look during Starmer's first term.
Well, the thing is, we talked about this election
a year
18 months ago when we discussed the fact that there would be a tactical switcheroo. The Tories would be the weak party of leftist social issues, and Starmer would be framed as competent, like, government Stalin man. And people would find him popular, because of course they would.
Yes, they would. But this is really our getting to grips with, and hoping that you can get to grips with, what the political landscape will look like, really, in about 2 years, I think, will be in full swing of Starmer. And unfortunately, for the man in the street, as this title says, things will appear, at least in the near term, to get better. It's amazing, isn't it, that the woke has already been put away. We're not going to talk about that here, because it's such a topic we've moved past.
Mm.
I'm sorry, but like, it's gone.
Yes.
The paradigm is gone. We already talked about the post-woke world. We've already discussed all this stuff to death. But Starmer stepping into the post-woke world is vitally important for this idea that politics will calm down and that things will in quotes, get better.
I mean, dare I step to the cliche that it might seem as if the adults are back in charge.
Yes, the adults will be back in the room. Thank you for the £2 there, Lewis Shaw Moffat, for going so much further, Ooga Booga, Mother Ruffers, and thank you, Ivan Grosny there, for the Theakston's Fund for £5.
Oh, yes.
We do love our Theakston's.
Thank you, comrade.
And we do say that you should go to the pub whenever possible. Do support your local pub. And like I said, super chats, super stickers, all that stuff's welcome. Memberships, we still have memberships and all that jazz, but we shall not shill for too long because there's quite a lot.
We shall get to the main crux of what we are discussing here.
Yes.
Which is, as always, completely and utterly stepping over ideology.
Yes.
Completely and utterly stepping over. I like how we've still got the little smoking PFPs as well. Is that just a choice measure for
today? I just
put
those back on, but I think we could do the cigarette. I just thought, what we are talking about, though, is the line going up.
Yes.
Where we don't think that things will actually improve, in quote. Although they will for certain people materially in the short term.
Yes.
I'll have to get this caveat out of the way. Again, bit of an intelligence test, because we are not actually saying that you should go out and vote Labour.
Oh, no, I would actually say you should. If I could make every single person that watches GB News vote for Starmer, and we could have like a, you know, Democratic Republic of Congo style election result where candidate A gets like 75 million votes in a country that's only supposed to have 72 million people in it, and candidate B gets minus votes, and candidate B is of course Rishi Sunak, then that is what I want. I mean, this is a fundamental part of this theory, is that we've experienced well over a year of the normalisation process of Starmer being sold to us as competent government.
Yes.
He is not, at this point, I think, going to get in and then mess it all up. There is clearly some level of, pardon the pun, but reform that they are intending to engage in that will make things better.
I think that before we go any further, I will say that it seems that Starmer and the people being cycled in are almost alarmed by how lethargic the outgoing government is and how little they seem to have had a rudder in the political project, to the point that they're really kind of upsetting the kayfabe a little bit. We'll talk about the kayfabe as we go forward, because that was the subject of our stream last week. But I just wanted to get the graph back up. It's a good graph. It's always relevant to managerial and liberal politics. The good line will go up, guys. Don't you worry.
But yes, we'll move along a bit.
Yes.
The globalist elite punish outcomes that they do not favour, and they go on to always reward outcomes that they do favour. This makes any decision that aligns with their goals inherently the correct decision. Any decisions that do not align with that are, therefore, incorrect. You are not on script. You're not on project. And fundamentally, what Tony Blair's vision is, the vision he's passed down to Starmer, and the wider vision of the Labour Party is more fundamentally integrated with this sort of path of correct decisions.
Yes.
As you say, it is a gear that better meshes into the nightmare machine.
I put the nightmare machine in capitals there because that's how I like to think of kind of what they refer to as the Whitehall blob, the managerial machine, you know, the machinery of state. It is just this giant machine, and you can't be within the system and try and run your gears the wrong way, which is what parts the Conservative Party want to do. What Starmer is doing is that he will materially reward the British people for getting with the program.
Yes.
Hegemony within the permanent bureaucracy makes it align with the permanent agenda of the post-war elite. Labour is more in tune with global governance, primarily via the Tony Blair Institute, but also among other bodies. It is much more in line with the other components there. I don't know. I'm quite happy with my little Tony Blair, well, my little Starmer and big Tony Blair gears there.
Yes.
But this is really how it all works. It's to do with creating these default environments, as the Nudge Unit will tell you. And as such, the Labour government will be much more in tune, in quotes, with the direction that the unions are going. A big thing that we'll go over, actually, I think it's one of the first things we'll talk about here, is the fact that a lot of the strikes that are currently happening.
Yes, I mean, I think this is something we've mentioned as an aside a few times on stream, but we'll emphasise it here. We have witnessed maybe not quite to that extent, but almost like near like 80s levels of consistent striking.
Yes.
Travel is a nightmare if you don't drive, and even if you do drive, it's a nonsense anyway. Fix yes. the potholes. Pothole Reich. You can't get a doctor's appointment for love nor money. Services like Citizens Advice have all gone down the Swanee. Fundamentally, the elite faction in Britain that better integrates with these unions and these services and will basically make them work and run on time is the Labour Party.
Don't worry, Massey Fox, we're talking about the Tony Blairs later. The Tony Blairs will be brought up, don't you worry. But the unions are not particularly powerful in Britain.
No.
They are a shadow of their former selves. They are not a power centre outside of the public sector in which they allow, they're allowed to, again, engage in political kayfabe, to create a situation where the public sector is rewarded with inflation-proof pensions and above inflation wage rises, usually to keep them sweet,
well,
to
yes.
pay them off for being part of the machine. But the idea that the unions under Labour could hold the country to ransom is a nonsense. A lot of this, I believe this will be the first big thing that Starmer does. He'll go out, he'll go, look, 8%, 10% pay, you know, if you're not a pay rise in years.
I'd even think it'd be that generous. I think they'll basically get offered just about inflation, and because at the end of the day, it's not about the mass body of the yes. union, it's about the people who control it and the people who make decisions.
It will be a 10% pay rise over 5 years.
And
they'll get 2% a year.
And those people are diehard Labourites.
Yes.
Not because of ideas, not because necessarily of ideologies or Marxism or anything like that, but fundamentally their position at the top of a union is bettered by being friendlier with the Labour Party and being an aggressor to the Tory Party. Because it means in the period that we are in now, where Labour, at least quote-unquote, isn't in power, having this little faction run around and make it difficult for the Tory Party, it's a benefit.
It is. It's so orchestrated in many ways. Mm. It's such a old political talking point, and the strikes have been so unenthusiastic and almost artificial. It almost feels like the people who are striking are tired of it.
Yeah.
They're going for the motions. There's not big picket lines. There's been no real run-ins with the police. There's no big like protest strike action apart from the normal performative protests you see over every issue. This is them going through the motions of industrial action. It's so dispassionate. It's so weird to watch this. Well, we're striking because the script says that we strike.
Yes.
It's a extremely mild-mannered and orderly labour dispute. It's really funny because it's so fake. The other thing as well is business. I'll go back onto the other slide, but a lot of this is being used to portray the Labour Party as being more in tune with British business.
Was their framing from Starmer's own sort of public address earlier on this afternoon. We are the pro business party. We are the pro growth party. We care about wealth creation. Where is conversation in that regards about British workers coming from the Conservative Party?
It's nowhere.
Yes.
This is a party that's going to portray itself as being ready for governance, and because so many of the problems in Britain currently are artificial, they're self-inflicted, and they're to do with, quite frankly, the laziness of an incompetence of certain officials that has been allowed to fester. This really will be a moment where they can have a very easy short-term victory, in quotes. And as we'll get onto it, it'll be very much like 1997, 2001, but you've got UK finance, international agreements, social issues, NGOs, all of these things, and as kind of the social stuff winds down.
I will say it's not noted here, but I've got it in as a little bit I added to the notes. There is also another massive part to this. Think of the bodies and the positions that have existed in the UK only since Blair.
Yes.
We have Supreme Court.
Ofcom.
National assemblies,
yes.
Mayoral offices, these are possessions of local power and influence that only exist at the behest of Tony Blair.
Yes.
And I think they exist at the behest not just of his actions, but also in some regards, his vision. These possessions are there to garner greater democracy and areas where he thinks it can be influenced to their benefit. They are practiced at this in a way that the Tory party is not.
Well, I didn't even put it in the notes because it's something I was going to bring up and we brought up many, many times before, is that the Conservatives inherited the machinery of Blair and let most of it sit idle.
Yes.
Whereas Starmer will inherit all of the machinery set up. I always talk about the dog days of the Brown government when they're forcing all these things through, and you've got the Supreme Court going through, you've got all kind of, you've got the starts of the Equality Act and the Child Poverty Act, and all these things are put in place that wrap up the government in all of these neutral procedures. And what Starmer will be inheriting is all of these gears he can now mesh with. He can now move in the direction that the Britain is supposed to, in quotes. He is able to better follow the script. And so the transition into, you know, new Britain is smoother, whereas under the Conservatives, it happens at pretty much the same pace. It is merely rougher.
Yes.
And that's because, as we always say, electoral politics isn't real. And Britain is governed by a permanent bureaucracy who are the ones who actually pull the quote-unquote levers of power.
Yes, I mean,
I just want to actually just keep flashing this up every few... Like, we need to remind you that as we talk about all of this, electoral politics isn't real, and it should underpin all of your thinking. Every time you start to become interested in the minutiae of the election, this image should appear in your head. You should repeat to yourself 10 times that electoral politics is not real.
100 times on the chalkboard.
Yes, and you cannot let it become real in your own mind. As again, very important as we talk about what's coming forward, none of this is the result of the will of the people or the election or democracy. He is being cycled in via that mechanism. That is all.
Sorry. I still want to come back to that. The example for me that I find so interesting is that in the early years of the Blair government, they set up these national assemblies in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, and they create a constitutional mess.
Yes.
They fundamentally make a problem that cannot be fixed.
Yes.
That especially a party that frames itself as unionist, which the Tories have done for a very long time, and it ultimately is part of their normie sort of appeal, is that they are for the union.
Yes.
They want Britain, not just England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland as separate, disparate nations. They want Britain. But they can't have it.
No.
Because Blair put them in a situation where the problem can't be solved by their own rules and their own constitution. But it's okay, because in Starmer's back pocket is a nice little document written up by Gordon Brown, probably at the behest of Tony Blair, that has a constitutional loophole to solve these assemblies. Whoa! Who'd have thunk it? What a coincidence. The same people that made the problem are the same people who have a solution for it.
There's some good examples here I'll take you through about the meshing of the gears and how countries are allowed to prosper when they get with the fucking program. A good example...
America in 2016.
Yeah, America in 2016 is a good example. But also, I wrote an article January this year about Poland and about Polish politics. The big fact about Polish politics and why it's so dominated by the EU, despite being a Eurosceptic state, in quotes, is because if you look here... You can tell on this graph when Donald Tusk left office in 2014, because the amount of EU investment tumbles until about 2017, until concessions are agreed with the EU and the Polish government.
It matters not anyway, because yes. Tusk is back.
Because Tusk is back, yes. I'll just read it here. Poland, despite... I'll read the first bit here. The simple reason Poland eventually had to play ball with the EU is this... Poland is the largest recipient of EU funds as compared to its contributions, larger than Romania, larger than even the much maligned Greece. Poland, despite retaining the zloty as their independent national currency, is heavily beholden to the EU financially. 37.41 billion in funds hang in the balance, mostly in the form of withheld COVID recovery loans. To put that in perspective, 2023 military spending, even in the light of the ramping up of the Ukraine conflict, was 24 billion, around 3% of GDP. 13.4 billion less than what the EU is withholding from Poland. This is a story that happens in microcosm everywhere. It happens in Italy, Italy is also a state that is massively beholden to EU credit instruments.
I could go through a couple of paragraphs
from,
if you want.
This is from our article, Maloney World.
Yes.
And this is kind of, it's about the...
Go to the little bit above and we'll just sort of work through it.
This bit here?
Yeah. The media, for their part, have been barely able to contain their gloating. This is you discussing the context of the fact that they want to paint her as a Nazi, whilst also celebrating the fact that she isn't one.
Yes.
Before becoming Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni was one of the most strident voices on migration in the European Union. As an opposition politician, she warned darkly of efforts to substitute native Italians with ethnic minorities and promised to put in place a naval blockade to stop migrants crossing the Mediterranean. During her time in office, she's taken a markedly different tack, presiding over a sharp spike in irregular arrivals and introducing legislation that could see as many as 1.5 million new migrants arrive through legal channels. How Italy's far-right leader learned to stop worrying and love immigration.
Yeah, love migration. That's a political article.
Other policy areas also show a degree of alignment.
A great degree of alignment, yes.
She has pledged money to North Africa, fully supports the NATO line on Ukraine and Israel, and has embraced the European Union wholeheartedly. She has even been credited as instrumental in brokering a deal to unlock a £50 billion, euro I should say, EU aid package for Ukraine.
It's $50 billion, sorry, I put a dollar there. I do a lot of my amounts in dollars.
Blocked by Viktor Orban. Political conditions in Italy are somewhat similar to those that I described in Poland. She's part of a broad church party, which is part of an even broader coalition, and crucially, Italy's repeated willingness to play along with the EU technocrats has led to a boon in EU funding. Money which Italy relies on to remain solvent and is contingent on following a brokered economic plan.
That is the key point when we talk about people like Meloni. Is that when you follow a quote-unquote agreed economic plan, you can get infinite international finance.
Yeah, liquidity in your nation no longer becomes a problem because every morning you phone up the European Central Bank and go, oh, well, we need another 12 billion. They say, well, you need another million Africans. Oh, done deal.
Yes. Financially, Italy has far more debt than the EU is usually comfortable with, but maintains something of a blind eye as long as Italian politicians play ball, with the implicit threat of simultaneous EU funding cuts coupled with demands for crippling domestic budgetary tightening. No Italian government can break free of its EU administrative cage without effectively detonating the current political system in Italy, but increasingly, the Italian population have demanded that they do so. It is clear that labelling Meloni as a fascist pre-election was not an attempt to smear her, but to bolster her in the minds of an Italian voter hungry to exit the technocratic EU management Italy has been under in various forms since the 2011 height of the sudden European sovereign debt crisis. Why is this relevant to what's happening with Starmer? Well, it's because if you get with the programme, you get much more access to international finance. It is actually the reverse of what happened with Liz Truss. Liz Truss made the mistake of not being Rishi Sunak and was able to be effectively removed from prime ministership via international bodies going, your economy's going to crash, your economy's going to crash, your economy's going to crash. And guess what happens? The markets go, oh, the IMF says the economy's going to crash. Oh, look, it crashed. That is the instrument used to punish undesirable results, i.e. get a non-meshing gear out of being Liz Truss.
I mean,
And the meshing gears are allowed infinite debt in the form of Meloni.
Where are the political articles, you know, having the IMF during Boris Johnson's last period of government discussing the fact that, oh, you know, the Bank of England had to print like £100 odd billion to keep all the pension funds up. And that was a non-story. That was a non-entity.
This is also in the wake of the massive funding for the lockdown project.
Mm.
And also a lot of... I know Liz Truss, for her part, was quite miffed about the fact that Jeremy Hunt... is referred to as George Osborne's tax cuts playbook. But really what happened is there was a few shuffling of the papers, but the tax cuts that were proposed were implemented anyway when it was the right people doing it. It's a great show that the international markets are a tool to guide governments and do not react to them.
Can I just say as a caveat, this is not as... give me a second. This is not as suggesting that Liz Truss is some renegade in the system.
No.
We believe that people at the IMF looked at her and went, oh my God, she looks fucking stupid. Pull the plug.
From their point of view, they did the right thing. From the managerial point of view, they did the right thing because Liz Truss is an idiot. and anyone who would try to staple her to some sort of dissident movement is not your friend.
Yes.
And is not anybody's friend.
But fundamentally, one of the major goals of any form of technocratic governance, be it left or right, is to satiate what ails the populists, or the populace, we should say. These basic and in-your-face sort of problems that the BBC or the Daily Mail or the Mirror or the Sun or whoever blasts in your face every day.
Yes.
With a little bit of tact and getting the papers on board, just as Tony Blair did, you see you're going to fix these problems. And all of a sudden people find themselves in a political malaise because they don't understand how the system works. They don't understand how it's better than it was before, but knowing that it is, they just think, well, okay, I'll leave them to it.
The first term of Blair, people do not talk. They talk about the 1997 election, they talk about the Iraq War, but they don't talk about what happened in between.
No.
Because what happened in between is that from the point of view of the UK population, Tony Blair oversaw a managerial miracle in that he was able to effectively and, in many cases, extremely boringly steer the ship of state into what looked like calmer waters.
Even if only by marginal percentages, yeah, and in the most possibly even menial ways, that alone was enough for them to turn round and genuinely say to the people, things can only get better.
And things did, from their point of view, get better, and you will find people who will still swear blind that Blair was good at first, and he was derailed by things like the Iraq War.
And it was Gordon Brown that really took it, yeah, down at the end. It was his
or
fault.
If you spoke to people in the year 2000 about what they thought of the Blair government, they wouldn't mention immigration because that was never in the headlines. It was never published what was being done. They wouldn't really mention anything apart the fact that they felt a bit better, they felt a bit more confident.
Isn't he better than that ghoul John Major?
Yes, it's much better than that ghoul John Major. And one of the biggest problems that they had, and one of the reasons that really, you know, I'm kind of on the fence about the whole zero seats thing and the initiative. I agree with the initiative to highlight the kayfabe. And what happened in 2001 was a massive drop in election turnout.
I think you probably have that again. Next time.
Probably next time. What happened was Tony Blair, and I believe it's in one of his biographies, the quote is that he put politics to sleep. He created this technocratic style of government was so uncontroversial and his victory seemed so assured and he looked so in charge that people didn't bother to vote. They disengaged from the process, which to the political class is terrifying. You see it in the tone of this article. This is actually a BBC article from 2001. 80-year low, a turnout 80-year low. Sure. General election turnout since 1945. There was a record low turnout, 58.9%. Yeah, the lowest turnout in the 2001 general election could be, as counting, this compares with the 71.6% of the 1997 general election, which itself was the lowest turnout since the Second World War. It would be the lowest turnout since the election of 1918, when the turnout was 57%.
Can we scroll back up for a second?
Yes.
Can we just appreciate the EV console button on the right there in this vintage version of BBC News' website?
That's a great thing. But this is what happened, is that there was this huge removal of political energy. And there's even, you know, explaining the turnout in the 2001 British general election, it became an obsession, almost, of certain of the political class. I'm not going to read this because it's, I can sum it up. A lot of people said that people, saw it as a foregone conclusion. They didn't want to go vote for the Tories because they felt they hadn't been punished enough, in quotes. But there was this general sense of political apathy, that the governance was so technocratic that they really felt that their voice didn't matter. But some people started to almost feel like it didn't matter that it didn't matter.
Yeah, the 2001 election was less an election and more an AGM or a board meeting,
yes,
or something.
It was...
people were so apathetic and so happy to just let bygones be bygones and allow things to run as they were that they just thought, well, let them do it.
Tony Blair, for his part, I can't find this, but I know he said it. His spin was, well, people are so happy
Yeah.
They don't feel like voting. People agree with us so much that they just want to get on with their lives.
I actually appreciate that to some extent. I think there's a truth to that.
There is a truth to that, but we must always remember that this original Blair boom was a lie, and that all managerial booms are a lie.
Oh, of course. This is why we are not talking in the sense of economic and material facts. This is about narrative.
Narrative. What we are talking about here is purely narrative. We all know where the boom times ended up. We all know what happened to the housing market. We all know where this story goes. I think you're all smart enough to realise what we're talking about here. But how did Tony Blair accomplish this? What did he do? He created a situation in which he portrayed himself as the purveyor of neutral governance. If you look at what was done post-1997, you will see that the power of managerialism is not in the realm of contested issues.
Exactly.
Its power is in how much of its operation is considered neutral, normal, and necessary.
And I think at its best, its ability is to take what are contested issues and frame them as things that are already decided upon.
Yes.
I mean, this is the Blair playbook, you know, move. This is the move number one. This is the first thing you try and do, is that you take an issue and you pretend the debate is over. It has been decided. We are doing this. We will move forward. There is a mandate. Any way that they can make it seem as if the issue is no longer up for question, that it's being needlessly political to debate the conclusions that we have already come to.
Yes, another £5 there from Cody Current Year. He says, are things going to get worse? I thought we were getting 5 years of integration. Will Labour failure be non-performative instead of performative? Eventually it will be, but we are getting basically 5 years of integration. Yes, we are entering the integration phase, guys. The agitation phase has passed us. The integration propaganda is here. But again... Okay, a good one to talk about, I think, with all of this, and it's something we just accept in Britain as the way things are now, when it was invented, really, by Tony Blair in 1998, devolution.
Yes.
Devolution was a massive shift, not only in how British politics operated in a real sense, because it was, it did operate differently. You know, electoral politics, again... Electoral politics, despite the election fever, despite the election fever, is not real, okay? The process isn't real, but the changes to the process were real. And because people buy into the process, the way Britain thought of itself as a country changed. It's the self-perception of the UK as a cohesive nation that changed, similar to the intended impact of what we'll get to, which is the new Britain project. But devolution was a stroke of genius on his part, really, because it allowed certain almost splinter parties of the regime to threaten Britain, especially England, if it were to become too right-wing, in quotes, with the detonation of the Union.
Now that Nicola Sturgeon has basically been arrested because it may or may not come to the light that a cocaine dealer she was very friendly with may or may have not come into a lot of trouble. Anyway, that's besides the point. What is the SNP as, you know, let's have this, you know, a system is what it produces kind of view, and we'll be realist about it. What has the SNP been in Britain? It has been a thorn in the side of the Tory party.
A thorn in the side of Corbyn?
That too. But primarily, thorn in the side of the Tory party, and a thorn in the side of people in Labour who were unionists, i.e. the folk that he, Tony Blair over here, wanted out.
Yes.
So... it's almost as if the SNP has entirely existed at his behest for his benefit.
And it's amazing that when his man's been cycled in, it undergoes what I can only describe as a controlled demolition.
Yeah.
They could have, it's very clear that they could have made the SNP go away at any moment. And now it is time for them to cycle back in.
Yeah.
They have.
They could have picked any week or any month or any year to have dug up Nicola Sturgeon's front garden and make her look like she'd murdered somebody. But they wait for this period.
The fact that you just don't simply laugh at Holyrood and say, you are a fake parliament made up by Tony Blair, like the fake Supreme Court, is an amazing act of political creation. The Welsh Assembly, the Scottish Assembly are real because we believe they are real. Yes. And we do not question their existence.
I also do imagine like a sort of a scene in a few months' time where as his last moment of sort of public humiliation, Alex Salmond is wheeled out in front of Starmer and Gordon Brown. They sit there and wag their finger and go, you work with the Russians, don't you? No, bad man. Yeah. You work with the Russians.
The big one also was, I've been showing little snippets from it, was the Kosovo War. It was Tony Blair's good war, in quotes. To quote the Shropshire Star here, which I just think is an amazing little quote here. You read this little paragraph here if you want. It's a great...
Joe, I might go from the top. We'll set the period. It was another great triumph for Tony Blair and the New Labour project. His term of office since 1997, he was the youngest Prime Minister for nearly 200 years, had been nothing if not eventful, with one of the early challenges being the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, in August of that year. Blair caught the public mood and articulated the grief of the nation, famously calling her the People's Princess. Blair has been dubbed Bambi by some in the press before taking office, but it was not a nickname that stuck when he came into power. Indeed, he proved to be not averse to military operations and pioneered the concept of a humanitarian war. When NATO embarked on a sustained bombing campaign in 1999 of Serbia and of Serbian targets in Kosovo. Less high profile was it a go-alone British military intervention in 2000 during a savage civil war in Sierra Leone. It was a success which brought an end to the conflict and made Blair a hero in that country, as he is in many others. I mean, I'm sure have you got the Tonnibler statue at hand?
No, this is all the Ponibblers in front of a picture of Tony Blair. That's what the background of the neutral governance is. That is the Tonnibblers. That is the Kosovan Tonnibblers.
Tonnibblers.
Yes. But I will repeat it again. The power of managerialism is not in the realm of contested issues. Its power is in how much of its operation is considered neutral, normal, and necessary. It is the Kosovo War never being questioned.
No, because it was the neutral. it was already decided before the first Serbian shot the first round. We already knew they were wrong and bad people.
Yes, this is a humanitarian war.
Mm.
Again, evil acts of political genius, but they are in service of awful goals.
And a further part to relate back to the issue of devolution is this. This want to make certain bureaucratic bodies be quote-unquote independent,
yes,
and non-political. And you do so by taking a large number of people who are part of one of your departments. You strip whatever is this before times partisan sort of body,
yes,
fill it full of your own people, and then say, look, it's a separate thing over there. Just like they did with the Bank of England.
Yes. I'll quickly... Sorry, I forgot one of our little slides here. I'll put that back there. But the Bank of England was one of the other examples. There's a great little article here. We like to open democracy because I just think they're funny. They say the right thing from the wrong angle a lot of the time, and it's really funny. It is no longer makes sense for the Bank of England to be independent. The bank's power over interest rates is political. Correct. It must not be held by unaccountable technocrats. Funny.
Yeah, but this is an important point here. The Bank of England and the start of government NGO, or the whole government NGO era, the public-private partnership, Blair's power was in redefining the conscious operating parameters and governance in seemingly banal,
yes,
and benign ways.
Like creating, we're not setting the interest rates.
The neutral,
normal, necessary Bank of England, who is not political, is setting the interest rates.
And I think the same will likely be done with artificial intelligence. They will essentially gut large parts of woke and DEI and whatever you would like to call it out of the public services, out of the NHS, out of the DVLA or wherever they can to get efficiency out of the machine. But they will do so under the guise that this is a neutral recommendation from computer systems that are entirely fact-based and scientific, not just a consequence of the fact that Blair looks at the radical left base in his own Labour Party with disgust, which is ultimately a large part of it, because they're stopping him from achieving what he wants to achieve.
Well, there's another thing to be said here, which you mentioned AI, which is going to be a big, I believe, or at least tech systems. The further systematizing of large areas of British life in a very normal, in quotes, boring, but also revolutionary way will be quite a large part of what Starmer's doing.
Yes.
And it will be done under what I refer to as the cloak of boringness.
Well, I just want to make one last point as well, though.
Yes.
They've done this before.
Yes.
I mean, there's a whole Adam Curtis section about this, that Blair comes in and his way to fix the public services is to marketize them.
Yes.
I.e., they sit there spending months and months and months coming up with a scheme for how to make all these things more efficient, implement that scheme, and just say, well, that's what the market told us to do.
Yes. I'm just going to put it on that slide there because that's a funny one. But a big example of this, the power of being boring, is New Britain.
Yes. the ability to take what are... Do you like 9 Turkish barbers on the same road?
Well,
do
you love New Britain.
Do you love vape shops run by people who don't look like they should be legitimate members of your community?
Well, you love New Britain.
Do you love the broccoli haircut?
Well, you love New Britain. Anyway, that's the famous New Britain stream. But it is an example of a constitutional project like devolution that sounds really boring, like devolution, that has massive implications for how, quote-unquote, politics is done, like devolution. Again, we can only say it so many times, but electoral politics isn't real. But what is real is the process.
And changing the basis of law and where power rests in Britain.
Yes.
I don't think we can fully explain it now because it did take us the best part of about 45 minutes to do so.
Yes.
On the previous stream, because it is just so... It's so difficult and so deliberately difficult because people who might even be interested in it will read 2 pages and give up.
It's deliberately dense. It's deliberately technical. It refers to the Assembly of Nations and Regions and the Council of Nations and Regions and the Council of the UK and the Council of England and the Scottish and Welsh and Northern Ireland Assemblies. And it's very unclear how these things fit together. This is our best guess at it. But really what it is infinite Soviet bus council.
Yes.
It is an East German factory board.
At the top level, what you have is an infinite loop of accountability where no one is ultimately responsible.
Yes.
No one's ultimately in power. It's all just people coming to consensus about things.
Deliberate overcomplicating of the process, in quotes, from its previous incarnations is a perfect example that none of this does anything.
Mm.
It is a Rube Goldberg machine that leads back on itself. It is a big circular system of no sovereignty. And when really all decisions are made outside of the political process. Everybody knows this. And if you don't know this, you're in the wrong place, and I feel sorry for you. But their whole project, their big project, is to make it as boring as possible to gum up the UK's systems of power, in quotes. So quite simply, they will receive, as the permanent bureaucracy, the global governance.
Mm.
And it will be talked about endlessly within this giant machine that does nothing, deliberately.
Well, that's why I would argue that that New Britain document in and of itself contains the basis for how they will implement globalist plans like UBI, like digital ID. You know, you'll have your minimum government infrastructure,
yes,
and there will be a big data system that makes sure you get your quota of the minimum infrastructure guarantee, and that guarantee will be held to a 15-minute, roughly sized locale that's part of this new regionality to further increase the democracy in the UK.
You see, this whole system is part of a wider global system, which each country has each of their own systems. And we go to the council, we decide, it's really just it's to make people go, and surrender to the fact that they don't understand the process.
I mean, go back one step, to the slide. Imagine this, and this is one country, and then you have representatives from each council of the nations and regions in each nation and region. So you go to the Council of the Nations and Regions of Nations and Regions, and that, you know, there's a million fucking representatives, and it's Tony Blair's wet dream because it's global EU, and it never gets anywhere. And as you say, only those who understand in and out and understand it's a facade can make the gears mesh.
Yes. Thank you, another cynical Brits, for the £5 there. And you're right, this is a system deliberately designed for people who know that the system is fake. And if you believe the system is real, then this will simply just tie you up in it. It's kind of genius.
Yes.
It's awful, but it's kind of genius. Immigration will come down.
Even if only in a narrative sense.
Even if only in a narrative sense, immigration, this is the big problem for basically everybody who wants to create a political energy after the election, because immigration will come down. I know people
crime
saying
will come down.
Crime will come down. It's the line, you know, it's the good line and the bad line. It, you know, it won't really come down, but everyone will swear blind to you that immigration and crime after the Tory mismanagement at the end of the 4 years or 5 years of Starmer will have come down. Because quite simply, it is unsustainable, even within their own bureaucracy, what they've been doing.
We can link this back to one of the earlier points, though. What is one of the main bodies that repeatedly stops, at least what we are told, the Tory party ministers getting people deported? The Supreme Court.
Yes.
Now, I think in Starmer world, Tony Blair basically taps the shoulder of whoever's at the top of the Supreme Court and says, now that we're in charge, you are going to let us deport people. And it'll just happen.
Yes.
But it's just that simple, and it is only, I think it's only until you realise that these people are above and beyond all ideas.
Yes.
That it makes sense.
Well, it's, again, a lot of the restriction, in quotes, or the controls, they say, the controls will be contingent on the technocratic policy. You'll have mandatory digital ID cards, which has been continuously and forcefully brought back onto the table over the last couple of years. It's been this emphasised now the election's going on, but it's still there, it's still floated, and it's still the plan. That is still their big idea of how to bring down immigration numbers is a mandatory digital ID system for the whole of the UK. That is their big idea, and it was Blair's big idea for ID cards, and if you think like a technocrat, that makes sense.
Yes, which is why, of course, our mandatory ID system will also have to be developed in partnership with a mandatory ID system across the EU.
Of course,
And that there will have to be a regulatory alignment during the process of that development so that there is not any bumps along the way.
Well, we've talked about, again, I cannot emphasise to you enough how important it is that the most evil things you do are the most boring.
Yes.
That is, again, that is why the New Britain document is how it is. But now we must talk about the release valve. We must talk about what will happen kind of in the immediate term post-election and why, really, the political energy you feel now
is only about to switch.
Yes, it's gonna go away and it's gonna switch in many ways.
Negative sentiment towards the regime will be shifted onto the outgoing Sunak government in the same way Blair was sold as a clean break from the 1997 Tory doldrums. He will act as an effigy, a sacrificial lamb onto which the sins of the managerial machine as a whole are shifted onto.
Yes. This is the ultimate purpose of the performance that is the peaceful handover of power, to convince you there is not a permanent regime with a permanent agenda. Unfortunately, zero seats could actually act as a release valve, letting people think they've sufficiently punished the Tories and allowing sympathy for their inevitable fusion with Reform and Tufton Street as a new Conservatives movement, one more neocon than ever in the American mould.
Equally, the massive Labour victory on a down-the-middle neoliberal strategy will allow them to portray the election as a referendum on the politics of both the Tories and Reform, and use it to say that the issues at hand, namely immigration, multiculturalism, integration, these things have been settled, and the country overwhelmingly trusts Labour's policy on these subjects.
The other side of this is obviously that there will be very, very naked consensus government.
Mm.
But I think that that is something that they think they can survive. It'll be, I do think it'll be quite fertile ground for us to show that in such forward terms, but these will be their arguments.
Yes.
And unfortunately, this is the other side. This is the judo that could be done on the idea of destroying the Tory party's electoral force without disengaging from the process entirely.
Yes, and as a final point, just to re-emphasise it, there is almost infinite narrative power to be gained from pulling this all off. 3-4 years down the line, if Starmer's regime is sans some sort of unforeseen disaster, they are guaranteed, and people can take my word on this, to have millions of people who think to themselves that it was the Tories and fundamentally Tory ideas that sunk Britain over the last 15 years. They will not see that it was just more naked and better integrated technocracy on Labour's part. Rather, in their minds, it will be the right, quote-unquote, that will have been at fault all this time, that it's right-wing ideas. These were the things that we allowed ourselves to get caught up in as fantasies, and people like Boris Johnson, they're the ones that ruined it for us. Because the adults are back in charge.
Anyway, there's a few more things I want to get through before we end up going here. Don't worry, guys, we're not out of material, but there's a wider discussion, I think, in a small part to do with the legitimization of the process. I know we're going to announce it more when we get close to the time. Probably next time we stream will be the last time we stream for a little while, because what we are advocating for, really, and what we will be doing ourselves, is the week of the election.
Switch off.
We will not be talking about it. The election is a foregone conclusion. The election doesn't matter. The number of seats, I'm afraid, that the Tory party get will probably hover in the 50s to the 70s. They can't be wiped out because of the boomer vote.
Fundamentally, the patronage network that keeps the Tory party alive isn't going to go anywhere, and that's something we're going to discuss next week. Fundamentally, elections are not real. They are a collective ritual which the entirety of a civilization engages in so that they can watch the political divination unfold before them. Even just sitting there watching the votes come in on your 24-hour election late night super stream or whatever it is that other people are going to be doing is buying into this mythos.
Yes.
And that mythos needs to be destroyed.
We've got a lot of people watching. As much as I enjoy the energy of it, as much as it is the best thing you can do with quote-unquote electoral politics, zero seats is still a project of electoral politics.
Yes.
It still believes that punishing the Tory party in quotes to the ballot box is going to accomplish something concrete, when really, unfortunately, it won't. It'll feel good, and there might be some stuff, you know, shook loose from the trees, and it's, you know, it's good fun to have your 2 minutes hate with the Tory party, but ultimately, it still buys into the process. We will not be talking about the election as it happens. The election has already, you must think about it like it has already happened. Do not think that the election will change anything. Do not think the election matters. Do not think the election is genuine. Do not think this is the process by which the handover of power happens. Do not believe in the process. You must exist in the political future. People get mad at us for doing so, but this has been a foregone conclusion for years.
I might see if I can even engage in a bit of friend of the working man style analysis here. Man City have just gone and won whatever Premier League or whatever this year, whatever the English big league is.
And
they've got all these charges against them, blah blah blah. Let's say, for example, the legal entity of Manchester City, the team, goes down south. You know, it goes to complete pot. The same football players, maybe with a couple of extra charismatic additions, play in the same stadium in front of the same fans against the same different teams and play to the same rules. What you call it, it matters not, because whether it's reform or whether it's the Tory party or it's some synthesis of the two, the backers, the people involved in it, and the people that turn up to make it part of a ritual are all still going to be there.
Yes.
I mean, this is something I think's should be most fundamentally understood by people who are like us. Going around and fomenting populist dissent without having a foolproof method for capturing that dissent and using it yourself is shooting yourself in the foot, because you're winding millions of people up and engaging them for action, and you're giving them no scope to use it.
You're giving
someone
them
else
to go.
Will.
Yes, if you create political energy, you better be able to harness it, or else somebody else will. And ultimately, that is the reason that, as I said, the election has already happened. Starmer has already won. You must exist in the political future, and you must look at what will happen when things get better from the point of view of the mass man, of the average Briton. Because in 2 years' time, you're going to hear nothing but people singing Starmer's praises, because he can lift the boots off the neck of certain parts of Britain, and he can do it by waving a magic wand, because he has always been able to do it when he has cycled in.
Yeah.
And that has always been the way that they will garner legitimacy. I agree with making fun of the process, but there's only so much you can do. And I said, we will not legitimize the process. There will be no election coverage from us because, again, it doesn't matter. It's a foregone conclusion. You should deglobalize your mind, disengage from it, and try and remove yourself from the election fever, from the massive time sink that is studying polls, that is studying the amounts of seats that the Tories will get. It actually doesn't matter what size the Labour majority is,
yeah,
apart from, you know, the fact that they'll have to govern in a nakedly consensus sense, which I think they were going to do
anyway. Well, why else is Rishi Sunak there? I don't want to have to grab people by the scruff of their neck and like slap them around. Oops, sorry, I bumped a little box. The microphone's on there. My apologies, headphone users.
Yes.
But Rishi Sunak is there because he's supposed to lose.
Yes.
He doesn't turn up at the D-Day event properly because you're supposed to
hate
him.
Look at him. He's sat there with the Wojak eyes on.
He's like the woke activists,
yes,
of 6-7 years ago. Do you actually believe anyone was trying to sell you Rishi Sunak as a charismatic leader? Do you think they're that fucking stupid? Because I can guarantee you, they are not.
All the effort, two leadership contests where they were told to vote again,
mm,
and then the removal of the winner to get that man into place so he can performatively lose.
Yes.
that's what it's all about. you put your ballot in, your ballot out, and you do the okey-dokey. Thank you to everyone who's donated. I'll make sure I've not missed any here. Louis Sean Moffat, thank you for the £2. Permanent regime, permanent revolution, same thing. Exactly. Very well said. We'll be probably back streaming next week, maybe our last one before the election or the week after. We're not quite sure.
If not next week, hopefully the week after, and then it'll be all quiet from us on the election front because it's not real.
Yeah.
And you should better yourself by not being a participant in it, even if only passively, because that's ultimately what they rely on.
We'll talk about it more next week, but we are advocating some form of... I know it'd be difficult for people. I know it's how people feed from the trough, but we would like to see some form of election blackout with basically a poster up saying, this isn't real. Anyway, I'll leave you with the ending music, and probably our last chance to use tech support Sunak, maybe.
Yes, thank you for doing the migratings.
Yes, thank you for doing the migratings. Thank you for doing the watching. Yes. We'll see you all later, and good night.
Good night.